Turning now to 1 Corinthians chapter 9 and verse 16. Very well known words in 1 Corinthians chapter 9 and verse 16. For though I preach the gospel, I have nothing to glory of, for necessity is laid upon me. Yea, woe is unto me if I preach not the gospel. Well, we're going to consider saving that which is lost, Christian witness in a post-Christian world, a title which has been assigned to me. I think this is the great concern of all of us, that we should study ways and means of reaching the lost in our day. But I'm going to make a strong plea for the old ways, conservative ways, because I think too often we're tempted to think that we need new ways, the old ways are no longer appropriate for today, or the old ways don't work. We're concerned about the proclamation of the gospel, and I want to begin just by underlining that word proclamation. Because whenever we're examining methods for the spread of the gospel, that is the key word. Is it a proclamation? Is this an explanation of truth directed to the reason of men and women? If it isn't, it's not a legitimate method. It's not a proper approach. Now, there are so many compromises and new techniques today, and I dare say every one of you is near to some church in your locality that has adopted seeker-friendly services or house meetings as a means of winning the lost, and or is contextualizing in one way or another. So I'd like to begin by referring to some of these things. There is a great movement which is generally called the Church Growth Movement. And it's been going now for about 45 years. And a great many authors, most of them seminary professors in the USA, a great many authors have contributed to a tremendous pile of books telling us how we ought to be going about winning the lost in our day. So I want to tell you a few things, make a few generalizations about the church growth movement. Many of these professors call themselves missiologists. And though you might think that's to do with foreign missions, it isn't. It's to do with all communication. It's the new term of two or three decades ago. The church growth movement. You know, having in the course of time examined an incredible number of books from church growth authors, you soon discover that they have a great deal in common. Some of them, if not most of them, are Arminian in theology. Some of them, however, are Calvinistic, well-known authors who claim to be Calvinistic. And the extraordinary thing is, their books run in exactly the same way as those of the Arminians. But mostly, the church growth movement, first of all, is strongly Arminian. Even the Calvinists write like Arminians. Their definition of a Christian is simply that somebody has made a mental assent to Jesus Christ. Even the authors who subscribe to, say, the Westminster Confession of Faith, when it comes to practical pastoral theology, the spreading of the gospel, they think and they write like the shallowest of Arminians. It's quite extraordinary. Man is the executive in his own salvation. If you can just get him to say yes, or change his mind, or make a response, however superficial, he has determined his salvation. He is now to be regarded as saved. All the church growth authors write as Arminians, even those who are not. And that to me is very significant, and I'll comment on that as time goes on. Second feature of all the church growth writers is that they are all ecumenical. They are all ecumenical in the sense that they're inclusivistic. Everybody, however vaguely Christian, whatever their position, is discussed and pointed to as though they were evangelical. They go round the world looking at churches that are growing. It doesn't matter what the character of the church is, they will applaud it, they will learn from its methods, they will extol its virtues, and so on. Even Robert Schuller's Crystal Cathedral is widely referred to in the church growth books as an ideal, a model. It's quite incredible, including, of course, the work of the late Mother Teresa, always extolled in almost all the church growth books as a prime example of somebody who has a wide Christian influence and opens hearts for the gospel. So all these authors, without exception, so far as I can see, are inclusivistic. You don't have to go more than two or three chapters before the late Mother Teresa's name is raised and applauded, and a whole lot of other people beside. All these authors seem to think that Roman Catholics are converted Christians. So it tells you something about their view of the gospel. Churches of any kind, anywhere, are regarded as valid and may be learned from. Now, I'm telling you these things because all the new things come from writers who may be called part of the church growth movement, whether it's Bill Hybels and his seeker-friendly approach, whoever it is, and they all answer to these characteristics. So when we're talking about non-traditional methods of outreach that are presented and explained in different books, they come from this kind of stable. All the church growth authors put quantity above quality. They never say, well, what is this church like? What kind of a church is it? What do the people believe? How consistent are they? For instance, they'll write up a church which maybe has 20,000 members, and we all know that those 20,000 members are not seen in church. The church probably has an auditorium which holds 6,000 people. They probably have 6,000 saved, so-called, every year. They attend one service on a Sunday and are never to be seen again and follow utterly worldly lives. And there's no indication, if you happen to know anything about that church, of any spiritual quality. But because there's quantity, the church growth authors love it. And they want to know how they got there, how they produced these numbers. No questions are asked. Quantity is always over quality. The church growth authors, fourthly, all seem to believe that methods determine results. If you're in a town and you're having poor results, it's because you're using poor methods. They don't make any allowance at all for the sovereignty of God in these matters. Now, I know we do not wish to give ourselves comfort. It may very well be that our results are poor because we're not doing anything like as much as we ought to be doing. We recognize that we all need to be challenged by what is accomplished and or what is not accomplished. But nevertheless, these church growth authors are different. They will say, if you will only adopt our techniques and put these things into practice, you will definitely get better results. There's no such thing as results being in the will of God. Some 100-fold, some 60-fold, some 30-fold. The yield being in the hands of God. And differing between different places, different ages, times in history. They take no account of that. Techniques count. Techniques work, in their view. Fifthly, the church growth authors hardly ever study the Bible. They may have a text at the front of a chapter. They may have a little bit of exposition somewhere, but they soon abandon it. Church growth authors study success. And they go around the world looking for it. Of course, sooner or later, they all present to us Yonggi Cho in Seoul, in Korea. Naturally, having the biggest church in the world, they're bound to home on him. A man who is a charismatic worker, who manages to put an awful lot of occult Buddhism into his teaching as well, whose methods and approaches are examined by the Bible horrific. But he's got the numbers, you see. And so they go to him, and he always features somewhere or other. They study success. If they find it in Latin America, however far from the scripture it is, they'll write it up, and they'll use its methods. Sixthly, though, the church growth authors have another strange thing in common. They never ever go back earlier than the 1960s. They never have any find anything interesting in church history, let alone in the Bible. What is past is regarded as fundamentally inept, and only what has come about since the 1960s is ever examined by them. If they refer to the past, and they should refer to spiritual awakening or anything of that kind, some of them like Finney for a few paragraphs, but he's too old to be worth any more than that. If they do refer to the past, it's usually to criticise, or to find some fault, or simply to pass off the past, why the Victorian evangelists only appealed to the middle classes, or something like that. They'll put them down, they'll write them off in some way or another. A number of other things that characterise many of the church growth books: they are all looking for alternatives to preaching. They don't like preaching. And many of them will give you an analysis or two to demonstrate that preaching is a very inadequate method of communication. They've got it in for preaching, without doubt. And they have some very interesting statistics. One best-selling church growth book, the writer did a large sort of survey, and he set out to ask the same people what they remembered from the previous Sunday's sermon. Notice the previous Sunday's sermon. There only ever seems to be one service in these church growth book churches. Anyway, as opposed to what they remembered from some soap opera they were in the habit of watching during the week. And of course they conclude that they remember lots of facts from the latest instalment of the soap and very little from the sermon. Therefore, the sermon is an inadequate and inefficient, ineffective way of proclaiming the gospel. Why, they say, it's all there was in the early centuries. They had no choice. But now we have a great deal of choice, which I don't understand, because again, this best-selling author says they had no choice and proceeds to extol the virtues of drama, and they certainly had drama if they'd chosen to use it in the early centuries. But anyway, they're not very concerned about logic or anything of that kind. They all love house cells. Now, I'll be a little gentle here, because there is such a thing as a perfectly good house church, a perfectly good house meeting. I don't deny that for a moment. If somebody convenes a house meeting under the auspices of their church for proclamation, and they understand that's what it's about, it's for teaching the gospel, well, that's different. If it's a house group, a house cell, which is formed deliberately in order to employ emotional manipulation, which is what most of them are organised to use, then of course it's anti-preaching, it's anti-proclamation. And that's what these church growth authors want you to do. They want to produce little house groups where there is a social closeness and a mutual dependence to a heightened degree, where it means a very great deal to each member of the house group to be there. These are their closest friends. These are their dearest friends. These are people who help them, watch over them, look after them. They mesh in together, and they're constantly together. If they can produce that, they tell you quite openly, then people will be much more inclined to accept the message. Well, that's pure manipulation. Of course they will be. When I was a teenager, saved in teenage in the 50s, there was a large young people's meeting in the church where I was. And I soon noticed this very early, that anybody who stayed in the meeting, any newcomer, for more than a few weeks, always professed Christ. Always. Even though they were most unlikely converts in different ways, and they were genuine, and they thought they'd professed Christ. But what was driving them? Because as soon as wave after wave of that meeting disbanded, either to college or to employment or whatever it was, most of them never continued. Most of them never stayed. What was going on here? Well, you see, that group meant a great deal to them. This is where their friends were. This is where they belonged. This is where they had fun and socialized and all the rest of it. But in order to be a good, upstanding, five-star member of the group, you really ought to have professed Christ. Otherwise, you were still an outsider. You were still on the fringe. So, not surprisingly, everybody did. a kind of emotional manipulation, really. Always be careful with young people's groups. Always be careful with young people's camps and young people's events. Do take care. If you've got a young people's meeting where the YPF goes out every Saturday night doing something together, having fun together, you know you will really create a lot of confusion in the minds of those young people, because you will be using an emotional technique. This means a great deal to them. They are bound to profess or embrace the message which they're required to profess and embrace in that group. So you should be careful with a young people's group. Never too much emphasis on recreation. Never too much emphasis on the things that young people like to do particularly together. This is not my subject, but I believe you should homogenize as far as possible the entire church. Do anything in the interests of evangelism, Sunday schools, Bible classes, whatever, college classes, but when young people profess the Lord, certainly over the age of 16, they should have no special provision, or at least very little special provision. It should all be in the adult congregation. You should be a homogeneous church. You should all be together. Well, that's my view. I can see some of you looking very dubious. So I'll change the subject. Anyway, the position is with the house group, there is a definite attempt at emotional manipulation. Why? People are encouraged to talk to the group. Talk about very personal things. Say what God has done in their lives. Tell about things which are actually embarrassing for them. And get used to doing this. Unbosoming themselves to people who are and of course that has, as you well know, a bonding influence. You disclose something embarrassing to a friend or somebody, there is a bonding influence there. There may also be, because of the embarrassment of it, a great release of emotion and tension. A catharsis will go on, abreaction, and you will be bound to that person in a deeper way. And then, of course, you will want to identify with that person or those people. You'll be more open to what they believe, to what they think. This is not an accidental thing. The house group authors and the church growth authors make no bones about it. This is deliberate. This is what you're to achieve. This is what is to happen, so that people are more inclined to receive the message. In other words, it's not an appeal to the reason. It's an appeal to the emotions. The church growth authors love you to work in age groups. Identify different age groups. 35 to 45. Regarded as very fertile ground by the seeker-friendly camp and the church growth camp. As long as you keep them in that age group, you'll find you'll create great openings in their heart and in their receptivity, they say. Why? Well, they've left youth behind. I'm sorry if you're between 35 and 45. There's a few home truths to face up to here. But they've left youth behind, and they're not as nimble as they were and all the rest of it, and they rather miss all that. They can't catch the bus and so on as effectively as they once could. They had left all that behind. On the other hand, there are now six noisy children in the house, and all the family responsibilities and extra hours at work driven pretty hard and so on. And they will especially identify with other people with precisely the same problems. Life getting busy, family getting busy, youth gone, all the rest of it. Almost more than 17-year-olds, they can be brought to relate to each other in a very special way. And if you can accomplish that, well then, you will find that 98.4 of them will accept the Lord instead of 14.2% of them, or whatever it is. Crazy statistics that they will produce, these church growth authors. But it's manipulation through kinship, through bonding, this deliberate focusing on age groups. Don't get them all into church and preach the gospel to them. Separate them up into groups. Do things especially for them. I'm sure you're familiar with another approach of the church growth authors. Find a hurt and heal it. Minister to hurts. Three times in this past year, I have been approached by ladies who have suffered a divorce, who have formed or are working for some kind of group to help divorced people. The last person, I forget what the organisation was, Divorcees International or something, let's call it. Anyway, the idea was, if within our church we would form a meeting for divorced people so that they could share their distinctive pains and difficulties, we would find it wonderful for evangelism. Just a technique, a piece of manipulation. Of course, in this case, the people who have spoken to me, I'm quite sure, were unaware of what they were doing. But this is actually promoted by the church growth authors. Entertainment in a big way, we've spoken enough about that today. There's one church growth author has a whole two chapters on how you should select music and hymns so that people are more receptive to the gospel. Another of their mottos is, close the gap between church and society. And that's exactly what they mean. Make the church more like the world. That's the whole basis of the seeker-friendly approach. And then people will be more inclined to listen to you. Why? Because somehow they're more open to the message of the gospel? No, but because they begin to think, well, if I go for this religion, this teaching, I won't have to be much different from how I am already. So they'll be more open, more inclined. So many different methods are taught. The reasons are these. These authors, they have no faith in the gospel. They really do not believe that the gospel is the power of God unto salvation. They don't believe that it, by the activity of the Holy Spirit, it commends itself to people, authenticates itself to people, convicts people, brings people into truth. They don't believe all that. They believe that it needs every ounce of help it can get from human gimmickry and manipulation. And this is what is in like a flood today. These church growth books, for a long time, not so much now, but they were number two behind the psycho-Christianity books in terms of popularity among Christian books. These church growth authors are incensed with the idea that we can do it. We can do it. If we want all world to be one to Jesus Christ by the year 2000, we can do it if only we could find the right way to go about it. And if only we could get all these churches all around the world to take up our prescription and do as we say. We can do it. They're obsessed with the idea. They don't seem to have any concept of the little flock. You are the children of the little flock. They really don't understand about the remnant. They don't understand that when Jesus Christ comes again, there's the great question mark, will he find faith on the earth? For some reason or other, they've missed that. They think that the minority can be a majority after all. And there is absolutely no spiritual obstruction for people coming to Jesus Christ, if only you have the right way of going about it. Of course, I think with some of these church growth authors, they're also motivated by very human considerations. They don't like the idea of being ministers or professors in small churches and small colleges, and when I say small, I mean anything below 500. They want to be significant people and special people. They want to be on the faculty of some vast institution. They want to be ministers of vast churches, and they seem to be driven by this kind of compulsion. We can do all that if we go the right way about it. So there are the church growth authors, and they're so popular today and so widely taken up. But what I'd like to do very briefly is to make a plea for the old methods, the old traditional methods, which home on proclamation. The methods that are legitimate either are proclamational, in other words, you are presenting and explaining and exhorting and persuading concerning the gospel, or they support proclamation. So the district visitation team may not directly be proclaiming, though many of them may be. They may be witnessing on the doorstep or seeking access to the home, but even if all they are doing, and this is a great task, is inviting people to services or special meetings, that is still proclamation because it's directly supportive of proclamation. The idea is to enable people to hear the word. So methods that are proclamational or they are supportive of that, these are the old methods, the traditional methods that we're all familiar with. But the trouble is, we think they don't work very well. Evangelical people, even of the most conservative kind everywhere, say, but they don't work. I was in a church for 30 years, they say, where the pastor preached the gospel faithfully, and certain things were done, and there was a Sunday school, and the fruit was so small. We're looking for something else. You see, the traditional methods are often very poorly operated. And it isn't always appreciated that there are several activities that need to be operated together. I don't know whether anybody's read Professor Behe's book, Darwin's Black Box. Anyone familiar with that? You are. Well, it's a tremendous work. The author of it is not... Perhaps I'll go into extra time for this, but the author of it is an American Roman Catholic molecular biologist. He does not himself denounce the theory of evolution, only the way in which it's perceived at the present time. So he's not one of us, so to speak, but this molecular biologist and biochemist has written a book which is very readable to us non-specialists. He has a brilliant style. He unfolds his case, then he gives you an asterisk or something, an indented text, where he proves it in technical detail, and you can just hop over that, you see. So it's a great book for the non-specialist. This man, actually, if he were converted and if he was a preacher, he would be brilliant, because his use of illustrations is remarkable. Powerful and amazing illustrations. And when you think he's not even a preacher, why, it's a reproof to preachers. But the whole idea of this book, and I'll tell you why I'm talking about it in a minute, is because Professor Behe, his case is to support design. Now he says that the whole field of microbiology has opened up, and the ability to measure the most intricate activity, the smallest possible units of human life, and to track what is going on, now all this is possible. There has been uncovered in minute detail the most intricate systems or activities going on which are so designed, so structured, that they could not possibly have evolved because no bit of them is dispensable with. And he gives this brilliant illustration, which is the illustration I want to borrow and twist. And it is this. He says, think of a mousetrap. This is the sort of way I like to see science taught. Mousetrap, that's good. I once had a physics teacher that tried to demonstrate the atomic theory with brooms and dustpans and things like that, which was just as impossible to understand. But anyway, take a mousetrap, he says. It has so many components. Platform, spring, all the rest of it. If you took one of them away, it wouldn't work. It simply wouldn't and couldn't work. It isn't possible to say of the mousetrap, I can see here how once upon a time somebody invented this with three components. And then someone else came along and said, oh, but it would work even better if it had a fourth. And someone then added a fifth. It is so complete in itself that take one bit away, or even one half of any bit away, it simply wouldn't work at all. And this professor is saying that once you can view biology in its minutest scale, you've just got masses and masses of little systems or activities using so many parts or proteins, whatever, and they simply wouldn't work if one bit was modified or taken away. And his whole point is this proves, of course, that creation as we see it, although he still holds to some form of evolution, is designed. Now, the mousetrap. Evangelism is like this. Proclamation is like this. there are several components that have to be in place. Take one of them away and it's very difficult to get the system to work at all. So we have to ask in our church, not am I preaching the gospel and visiting the community and engaging in personal witness? We have to ask if we are properly pursuing all these activities together and in a right relationship. And that's crucial. After all, I think I may have told you this a year ago, I seem to have some recollection of it, but in 1859, revival year, the Metropolitan Tabernacle, whilst Spurgeon was the minister, they had absolute record numbers of people come to faith in Jesus Christ. And the interesting thing was that the testimonies of all these people exist today, and you can read them. They had a brilliant elder, Elder Moore. He used to summarize everybody's testimony and record it in his own beautiful script in the Minute Book. And so you can study, how did these people get into church? What brought them in? We think of revival and we expect all the people to come floating through the door. And you read these testimonies and you find the vast majority of these people came under the sound of the preaching as the result of personal witness, as a result of being spoken to, helped, challenged by some colleague at work, somebody in the same building. You see, used to get 5-6 families to a simple artisan's cottage in the area of central London in those days. They say that Metropolitan Tabernacle last century was a working class church. You should see the minute books. You should see the number of times the same address occurs for family after family after family, and you realize that these were all families living in single rooms, crowded into little houses. Somebody is talked to by a neighbour, somebody in the room above. They see their life. Almost everyone who comes in as the result of personal witness. You see my mousetrap building up. You can preach away to your heart's content, but if the whole church isn't witnessing and active, where is it going to get you? How are you going to advance? You'll get some people in, but you won't get many. Now, I'm sure I'm not telling anything you don't really know. So let's go through some elements of evangelism in our churches. They are all conservative. They are all have all been employed for a very long time. But they do all, or nearly all of them, have to be represented together in our approach. First of all, then, and I shall go very quickly through this, gospel preaching. There must be evangelistic preaching. The Catholics, traditionally, have said that the gospel equals the grace of God, or words to that effect. Therefore, anything the church does is the gospel. Whether it's sacramental, whether it's teaching, whether it's social work, whatever it is, everything which can be construed as an aspect of grace channeled by God through the church, the whole lot, is gospel. And Protestants always used to object to that. They used to say, no, gospel is the soul-saving doctrines of the word. Gospel is that part of truth whereby souls are saved and justified and brought to God. So there was always a completely different viewpoint. The Catholics, grace of God generally, the Protestants, it is evangelism. It is soul-winning. Then along came the liberals. Of course, they didn't believe in the gospel, and so they also said, with the Catholics, the Protestant liberals, gospel equals any good work, any social work, anything done by the church. And again, the evangelicals of anything above 50 years ago used to insist that gospel equals evangelism. Now, we have gone down the same route, and the average evangelical preacher, even, I'm sad to say, in reform circles, if you ask them what gospel means, they say it's a synonym for the whole Bible. Whenever I preach the gospel. When I'm edifying the saints, I'm preaching the gospel. Whatever I do, it is the gospel. And I've heard an address some years ago in which a preacher went to great lengths to prove that the gospel did not equal only soul winning, but he didn't use the scripture to prove it. Gospel is a technical term in the New Testament. It is a technical term which always, 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 without exception, means those doctrines of the word which will bring, when preached, a sinner to faith in Christ. The word gospel is used many times in the New Testament, and always it is used in a soul-winning context, with only one exception, which is debated, and that is plainly the same as the others. So, friends, we must engage in gospel preaching. When you consider this, this text hits you. Woe is unto me if I preach not the gospel. Any Bible-believing, sincere preacher who thinks that gospel is a synonym for the whole counsel of God, all the counsel of God, if he's not preaching the gospel on a regular basis, this verse will not challenge him. It's explained away for him. But if he understands that gospel always means evangelism, then he looks with horror at these words, woe is unto me if I preach not the gospel. And he becomes an evangelist. He sets aside at least one of his services every Lord's Day for the preaching of the everlasting gospel. That's the starting point. No gospel ministry in a church, nothing can be done. No regular, persuasive gospel preaching, nothing can be done, friends. You may as well give up. I'm sorry to put it this way, but you may as well give up and join another church. Oh, but they believe the word. If you can't persuade the minister to preach the gospel, you've had it. There cannot be church growth on any scale, only relative stagnation. Now, I don't want to be hurtful when I say this. Oh, I wish I could go around the country putting a great firework under people sometimes. Because everywhere, people come and they say, oh, we went on holiday and we went here and we went there. Dear brethren, who you respect, who are deeply taught in the things of God, no gospel preaching. Somebody says, I went to do my postgraduate training in such a town. For a whole year I went to this church, wonderful church, great fellowship, great teaching, no growth, no gospel. No evangelism. Friends, where are we going? What is going to happen? What's going to happen to this country? Here we are, going down and down increasingly. Hardly a month passes without there isn't some fresh indication of how atheistic and immoral we're becoming as a nation. And the churches seem to be smaller and smaller and increasingly ineffective. No gospel preaching. No evangelistic preaching. If the minister doesn't preach the gospel, well then, souls will not be challenged. But furthermore, the people of God will never reach, really, their full position in worship. Because it's the gospel which awakes us to a fresh realization of what God has done for us. And also, the people of God will never go to college to be trained as good witnesses. If the preacher is an evangelist and he's using all the wonderful persuasive arguments of the Word of God from throughout the Word of God, then what will happen is this. The people will be trained. And when they engage in personal witness, they'll know the arguments, they'll know the illustrations, they'll know just how to go about it, they will not be tongue-tied. This is a fact. If we have a regular evangelistic service, we're not only seeking by God's instrumentality to win the lost, but we're running a training school for Christian people in their witness at the same time. So we must have gospel preaching. Oh, if only we could bring that about. Secondly, of course, we must have personal witness. The people of God must constantly be urged and encouraged to involve in personal witness. That is so obvious. Bedrock in the book of Acts, where in the early chapters you see all believers involved making known their Saviour until they had filled Jerusalem with a knowledge of their doctrine. Amazing. Can we do that in whatever town God has put us? Fill the town with a knowledge of our doctrine. We can't do it without personal witness. We cannot do it without district visitation. And I'm coming to that. Third element I'd like us to think about is the necessity of the visitation of the community. Just as in New Testament times, just as in the opening chapters of Acts, we must visit the community. Oh, but it doesn't work. We tried it. It doesn't work. When did you try it? Oh, about 10 years ago. For how long did you try it? Oh, must have been at least a month. How many people were involved? 3 of us. Well, nobody's tried. District visitation on that basis. You want as big a team as you can have out. And if people can't talk, they can deliver. They can hand over materials. But friends, we must be engaged in it. You know, this is a ministry of judgment as well as a ministry of salvation. One day God is going to judge this community on the basis of what you said to them. So it's not only a matter of saying, oh, it's so discouraging because not many people came in, not many people were saved. Yes, but people were warned and people heard and people knew. And God, in any case, will use it. There's no doubt about that. Fourthly, I'd like to talk about child evangelism. There is so much said against the Sunday school these days, and against child. You even hear, one of the most fantastic pieces of reasoning I've ever heard, I heard a couple of months ago. There is no biblical warrant for a Sunday school because it would mean that the scripture would have to be broken, because most of the teachers would have to be women, and the women are to keep silent in the churches. Can you imagine that? The absurdities people are going to these days to try and dispose of the Sunday school. Well, let me put an emotional point in first of all. If we are not bringing in as many neighborhood children as we possibly can into Sunday schools, they will never be taught even basic moral values, let alone the gospel. We are the only people who can make any difference to the attitude of this nation. If wherever there was an evangelical church, there was a strong Sunday school, and had been over the last 30 years, what a powerful difference it would have made. I often mention this in connection with Brother Ian Murray's biography of the late Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones. And he speaks of how, when he was ministering in South Wales, there was great blessing, and no doubt there was great blessing. But it's rather put across in the book as though all you have to do is preach. Just preach. Take the great Dr. Lloyd-Jones. He just preached, and look what happened in that town. Now, you know, he undoubtedly was an instrument of God to bring about a wonderful result. But he wasn't the only one working. Because in that town, in Port Talbot, almost every man, woman and child in the previous few decades had passed through evangelical Sunday school. They had trained consciences. They knew what something of what this message was about. They may have been apostate and far from the Lord. But oh, if only you and I could stand up in pulpits in towns where the entire town had come to evangelical Sunday school. What a difference it would make. What are we going to pass on to the next generation of preachers if the Lord delays his coming? When all we have so often is something like an all-age creche for the children of Christian parents. Teaching things to children of Christian families, and no compassion for the outsider. I wish I could spend some considerable time on this, but I can't. But I believe there is a very powerful biblical warrant for child evangelism. It is a great responsibility for all of us. I'll mention just one thing. As my noble host overran, maybe I can. Just a little. But if I may lay claim to self-righteousness, it won't be as much. You hear it said, the Sunday school was a late arrival on the scene of church history. The Reformers didn't have Sunday schools. The Puritans didn't have Sunday schools. It's a late arrival, so why should we have them now? People do forget things, you know. Anybody who knows church history or English history knows why the Puritans didn't have Sunday schools. Incidentally, for the same reason that the Puritans didn't do anything to try to bring in the outsider. If you want to learn how to operate your church today and how to win people to Jesus Christ today, don't go to the Puritans, because there were certain things they didn't have to do. Because by force of law, every adult and child had to be in church every Lord's Day. So So of course they had Sunday schools. They had the children under instruction by force of law, and they separated them off for separate instruction also. So don't say the Sunday school was a late arrival. And when the law ceased to have its binding power, social convention took over. And if you worked on Farmer So-and-so's farm, he'd sack you, and you'd starve if you didn't go to his church. And it wasn't until the early 18th century that this began to collapse. And it only began to collapse in the cities, in the towns. All around the world today, in the developing countries, people are abandoning the villages and swarming to the towns, which develop great ghetto areas. Well, we had all that at the beginning of the 18th century. People began to run from the land and go into the towns, and towns became swollen in size. And with this social phenomenon, there came an underclass, the unchurched poor. And the poor little children with no shoes on their feet and rags on their backs and nothing to eat very often. And by the time this was in swing and the great Methodist awakening took place, 1739 and afterwards, one of the first things that happened is those newly converted people of God saw the city poor, the unchurch-going city poor, the people, the inadequates among them who'd come in for the villages, the people who simply couldn't get work and care for their families, and they began to open ragged schools and Sunday schools everywhere. The truth is not that the Sunday school was a late arrival, but it was a quick reaction from born-again hearts to meet the need of the hour, the new non-church-going population which had arisen in the early half of the 18th century. Oh, friends, there are many, many things that I could say on this theme, but you must have a growing Sunday school. You must, if you haven't got one, inaugurate one. Make it a gospel Sunday school. Make it a Sunday school which is supported, many teachers, constantly growing, constantly being visited for. We must reach the young. And you know, if I were to ask you to do this, but I won't, I often do this in all parts of the world. If I were to ask all people who had been saved as youngsters, touched in some shape or form through Sunday school, even today the majority of people in any Christian gathering like that, this would raise their hands. Yet, no single week goes by without I learn that another Reformed church has closed its Sunday school. So, in a few years' time, a couple of decades, you'll say, how many here were converted through Sunday school? Nobody will raise their hand, but there'll be very few people in the meeting. You must have an evangelistic Sunday school. It's crucial. If I can anecdote, when my wife and I started pioneering in a town about 13, 14 miles north of London, in the beginning of the 1960s, we started with a Sunday school, not because that was our wisdom, but because that's what we'd seen done. We started with Sunday schooling. Now, a brother my age exactly, who started pioneering in another part of the country at exactly the same time, took the view that Sunday schools were not biblical. Convert the adults, they will instruct their children. About 5-6 years later, we had a building, fair-sized congregation, vigorous church, reaching into the community. The other brother had the same 5 or 6 people he started with. And then he buckled and opened a Sunday school. And of course it's been much better ever since, as you can imagine. We need to be ministering to the young, to the rising generation. We must do it. Well, holy living is a fifth vital element. Without holy living, of course, people will not be impressed by us. Witness will have no effect. Sixthly, we need to be proclaiming in special places. Evangelicals have always proclaimed the word in special places. In the days when you could proclaim it in the market square, they did it there. They always looked for the place where the people would be gathered. So if you've got any special place, you've got nurses' homes, student halls of residence, barracks perhaps, even a prison, and homes for children, any such places, do your best to get in if you can. If you've got a local newspaper, then even if you have to bribe the editor with an advertisement, try and get a few inches in it. Say something on a regular basis. I must tell you about a dear brother, a Tamil brother, who was at the Tabernacle Seminary, and he went to Toronto, where he was asked by a church there to minister to Tamils living in the neighbourhood, and found a Tamil church, and he did. And he was a live wire, this lad. And first thing he did was go around all the hospitals and say, "Do you have trouble with Tamil casualties?" "Yes, we do. They don't speak English. Here's my telephone number. Call me. I'll come. I'll do the interpretation." And they did it. And so he was into these hospitals. "While I'm here," he said, "I'd like to be your Tamil chaplain." Certainly. He's Tamil chaplain to half a dozen hospitals in downtown Toronto. Then he went to the local public services radio station. He says, "You're broadcasting in Tamil to the community here so many hours a week. Can I buy a program?" So they sold him an hour a week. Half of it was evangelism. The other half of it was instruction in bringing up the family, which amused me greatly because he wasn't even married at the time. But anyway, and then he ran out of money and he couldn't afford it. He was off the air, and so many people wrote in. To this day, he has that program free now, an hour a week, free of any charge. I could tell you a great many things that this brother has done. And God has blessed it and God has used it. These are not gimmicks. This is proclamation. This is explaining the gospel, presenting the gospel. And sometimes I think we've lost our imagination, haven't we? We don't look to all the places which we could possibly visit. We need to give special support to individuals. It may be that in your congregation there is at least one person, if not two or three, extraordinarily good at fishing. Stand behind that person. I know everybody should be good at fishing, but sometimes there are one or two people who never come to church without somebody in tow. They seem to be able to get everybody they talk to. Well, support them. Give them literature freely if they need it to support their witness. Encourage them. If they're bringing in students from the hall of resident, somebody lay on tea. That lad probably comes from an unconverted family. He can't afford to do that. He hasn't got the facilities for doing that. Support him. Look at the people who are effective for Jesus Christ and give them all the help you possibly can. Especially hostel inmates. Because these days a lot of the hostels won't let you in, will they? If you get a student who's in a hostel, he's your entrance into that place. Go and visit him every night if necessary. Until you've covered all the rooms along the corridor, you know. He's your open sesame. Well, watch out for particular opportunities, special people. Be very richly endowed with literature. It's proclamational. Different types of literature, tracts, materials, even different books. We have a brother who has formed a kind of library, as I was talking about this earlier, a library of anti-evolution books. All of the books in his library are written by non-Christians. All of the books attacking evolution that he has are by people right up in their branch of science who have no religious axe to grind. Because those books, if he is witnessing or bringing in students who find this is a hang-up, well, that's much more effective for them. That seems to make an impression. You need literature to support the work, and you may need to make it freely available. Oh, there are so many things, friends, we can be doing, but I'll close with one or two final exhortations. You must believe in the working church. I've got a little booklet on this, but you must believe in the working church. In the last century, there used to be a procession of people went to the tabernacle to write about it. And then more or less, we've got a scrapbook absolutely crammed full of different articles written about the ministry at the tabernacle. In fact, it's in three volumes. People divide into two camps. They either tell you all about the preacher and extol him, celebrate him to the skies, or they talk about the tabernacle as a whole. And you'll have ministers will come, and they stay a week, and they express their astonishment that so much is going on, that the place is a hive of activity, that there are so many different things that the people of God are doing. Because C.H. Spurgeon was not just a pulpiteer, he believed in what he called the principle of the working church. All the people of God who are fit and able, of course there is the voluntary principle we have to honour, but all the people of God, so far as we can persuade them, are engaged in Christian service in some shape or form. That's what makes the difference. Then you can run a big Sunday school. People say Sunday schools are no good these days. Well, I'll tell you, a Sunday school in most towns, at any rate, is as big as the amount of work you can put into it. Or as big as the premises. There's no question about it, you can still get in the children. You may have to drive them in, you may have to pick them up, but you can still get them. And we have about 750 children on our Sunday school roll at the Tabernacle, and we are in trouble because every nook and cranny and broom cupboard and everything is full of children on the Lord's Day at Sunday school time. And we have now having to develop in order to get the Sunday school in. And it's only because there are a lot of people committed to it, dedicated to it, from visiting through to teaching. But you can't do it unless you believe in the working church. We could never do that if there were not 50 to 100 teachers alone in the different places ready to come forward and visit and do the work, could we? 10 people couldn't do it on that scale, a dozen people. The working church is the key. It's not what Jesus does for me, it's what I do for him. When I was converted, this is what it was all about. You pray every day, you read the Bible every day, you witness every day. You seek to do something for the Lord every day. That was glorious, godly Arminianism. And even among Arminians, it's all gone now, isn't it? It's not like that anymore. It's not what's taught. You must have a working church where the people of God are really committed. Well, I must come to conclusion. But these things are so vital, friends. A lot of things I could talk about, basic values. I'll close with just one. Make sure that in your church you've got a true and an effective prayer meeting. You can't survive without this. Not a prayer meeting which only worships, though that would be a very ideal activity for a prayer meeting. Not a prayer meeting which on the other extreme just talks about bumps and bruises. I went to a prayer meeting once in America, and most of the prayers were about little Tommy, who'd fallen down on the way to school and bruised his knees. I was amazed. These people live in a godless community. They've all got contacts. There's different departments in the church. Well, I have every sympathy for Tommy and his knees, but really I don't think it had any place in the prayer meeting. Certainly if people were seriously ill, yes. The bedridden and the seriously sick, the people who are in pain of body or mind, because James tells us we must pray for one another in that way. But the prayer meeting, oh, your prayer meeting must be an asking meeting. It must be a meeting where all the needs of the church are brought in, for mainly with a view to evangelism. Make sure your prayer meeting is an asking meeting in which as many people as possible attend and contribute. And God will bless. He will answer prayer. He will bless the preaching of the word. He will bless the visitors. He will bless the Sunday school teachers. He will do it. He will bless those who honour the principle of the working church without doubt. We don't need any new things. We don't need any gimmicks. We don't need any manipulation. If only we could operate what we've got and properly, we would see the power of the Spirit through the Word without any doubt. Well, I'm sorry for taking too long. I've been watching you very carefully. You have all looked interested. So if I've tired you, the fault is equally yours. But may God bless every servant of his in this place.